on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4, here on Radio Catskill.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, hate has no home here. A rally today in Liberty to shed light on those who have suffered directly or indirectly from attacks upon faith, race, or identity. Recruit New York, finding new volunteer firefighters. An event this weekend to address the national shortage, which is also happening locally, in volunteer firefighting. Feeding the horse. No, not the animal. It's a food scrap digester. And it's here in the town of Tustin. We'll tell you more about it. And Enfoco, a nonprofit that supports contemporary U.S. photographers of African, Asian, Latino, and Native American heritage, their exhibition at SUNY Binghamton. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. The one-shot Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine is back. NPR's Windsor Johnson reports the U.S. lifted a suspension after examining reports of rare blood clots.
A CDC advisory panel voted to resume the use of the single-dose vaccine nearly 2 weeks after the FDA suspended the shots. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky says the benefits of the J&J vaccine outweigh the extremely low risk of blood clots.
The science supports this news, and I know that this is welcome news for many, as many have wanted the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to fill an important need in vaccination efforts here and around the world.
The FDA says a causal relationship between the vaccine and blood clots is plausible. In response, the agency says it will add a warning label, noting that most cases have occurred in women between the ages of 18 and 49. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
Early this morning, a SpaceX capsule docked at the International Space Station. NPR's Giles Snyder reports on a voyage filled with firsts.
Four astronauts arrived at the International Space Station aboard a SpaceX crew capsule that's already made the trip once before.
Heart capture complete. Welcome to ISS. We are so excited to have you aboard.
Space Station Commander Shannon Walker welcoming the four astronauts joining the crew of the orbiting outpost. They represent the U.S., France, and Japan and include Americans Shane Kimbrough and Megan MacArthur. Not only did they arrive on a recycled capsule, they were also propelled into space by a previously used rocket booster. There are now two SpaceX capsules docked at the ISS, another first. The newcomers are replacing four astronauts who will return to Earth and one of them on Wednesday. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
In North Carolina, several sheriff's deputies are on leave or have resigned after the fatal shooting of a black man on Wednesday. NPR's Sarah McCammon reports from Elizabeth City.
The actions come after Andrew Brown Jr. was shot and killed on Wednesday morning while Pasquotank County Sheriff's deputies were carrying out a search and arrest warrant in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. The sheriff's office says seven deputies have been placed on leave while state law enforcement officials conduct an investigation. Officials say three other deputies have resigned, though they say those departures are not related to the fatal shooting. Pasquotank County Sheriff Tommy Wooten says his deputies were wearing body cameras at the time. Members of the Elizabeth City Council have voted unanimously to ask the sheriff and other officials to release that footage. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Elizabeth City, North Carolina.
Investigators in Tennessee are looking into another fatal police shooting. It happened overnight in Nashville during a traffic stop. Body camera footage shows a man getting out of his car and the officer demanding he drop a knife. After briefly running away, the man turns toward the officer, who fires three shots. It's NPR News. Derek Chauvin will be sentenced on June 16th after being found guilty this week of murdering George Floyd. The former Minneapolis police officer is facing a maximum of 40 years in prison. He was convicted on Tuesday on all three counts against him, including second-degree unintentional murder and second-degree manslaughter. Universities across the country are announcing they will require COVID-19 vaccines for students returning this fall. But Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sieg reports one school in a rural part of the state says it will not be making any such requirements.
Colorado Mesa University won't follow in the footsteps of California's public universities or Maryland's. CMU Vice President John Marshall says his school will take a different approach to vaccines.
I think just being respectful and sort of extending people both agency and courtesy and respect as we work through that vaccination conversation is really our best path forward.
CMU is in a largely conservative community with a lot of vaccine hesitancy. But at a recent on-campus vaccination drive, nearly 200 students and community members showed up for a shot. For NPR News, I'm Stina Sieg in Grand Junction, Colorado.
A second coronavirus wave gripping India is worsening. The country broke a world record for new cases today for the third day in a row. India's health ministry says it has more than 346,000 new infections, and the country's health system is getting overwhelmed. I'm Amy Held in Washington. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today at 1, the Committee for Equity and Justice is hosting Hate Has No Crime, Has No Home, excuse me, in Sullivan County. The rally will be held at La Polte Park on North Main Street in Liberty, and the event hopes to bring to light those who have suffered directly or indirectly from attacks upon faith, race, or identity. WJFF's Jason Dole spoke with community activist Dana Halpern, who's organized several Hate Has No Home events around the area since last summer's protests over the killing of George Floyd.
What has been the reaction to all the events that you've had so far from the people that you've attended and what you might have heard anecdotally from the community? What are people thinking? How are they feeling?
It has been a pretty positive reaction from pretty much everybody. This is something, it's not a politicized event. You know, we invite folks from all walks of life and all sides of the political spectrum to come to these events, as long as they're coming with a message of positivity and love and compassion for their Sullivan County neighbors. It's kind of hard to be anti that.
Yeah, really. I'll second that. And to what extent do you think, like, the rallies, marches, and protests last year after George Floyd's death, which was really part of a whole spate of killings of unarmed African-Americans that grabbed the attention of the nation, to what extent was all of that having an impact on these conversations that you're having in the community?
I mean, obviously that all is having an impact, and we really, so many things have become so divisive, and, you know, we really just want to unify the community a little bit more. And if folks don't feel comfortable or they don't feel like they want to support marches and demonstrations in support of Black lives, then this is just another opportunity for them to come out and to be unified within the community. So, you know, we really hope that everyone will feel comfortable coming out under this Hate Has No Home in Sullivan County banner.
Well, that answer, following what you're saying, like, you know, it's kind of hard to be opposed to these ideas. I mean, it sounds like you're trying to, I guess, get out of the boxes that the conversation, the national conversation, is has wound up putting a lot of people into. Like, you're trying to find a way, because that's what we all do. Like, those of us who are involved in holding conversations in the community, trying to get information across, we're constantly asking, it's like, well, how do you even reach when things are this divided, when it's hard to even talk about any issue because people really have some strong preconceived notions? Sounds like you're looking for hands-on practical ways to take that head on or just move past it.
Yeah, exactly. And in addition to these Hate Has No Home events, the Committee for Equity and Justice also hosts the monthly community conversations, and that's been occurring virtually for now. And that's just another opportunity for folks within the Sullivan County community to get together and have what we traditionally call like the difficult conversations, conversations surrounding race and a lot of other issues that have divided us. And then that's another opportunity to, like I said before, unify this community and, you know, hopefully try to get us all back on the same page that, you know, things like human rights and civil liberties, those aren't politicized issues. Those are things that everybody should be fighting for and standing behind.
I mean, this was, I don't know, any given week can be a big week in terms of the national news. But I mean, this is a week where we saw the verdict come down in the trial, the murder verdict for Derek Chauvin in the killing of George Floyd, as at the same time that we just saw a funeral for another killing in the same community there. This is part of the, you know, anywhere I look on the national level, people are having this conversation right now. Just what does this mean? If anything, what happens next? Is that part of, are we going to hear anything about that at this event?
Yeah. I mean, I personally plan on speaking about that a little bit, but it is hard when people see that as such a politicized issue, and we are really trying to keep the politics out of this specific event. And you know that I host and organize and participate in other events that do address those topics more directly and are what people might see as more politicized. But I do definitely plan on personally addressing those recent murders at this event because, like I said, you know, human rights and civil liberties are not politicized issues.
What are some issues locally that fit under this category of things that are above or beyond politics? Like what are some local issues that fall into this category that people could talk about as a way of moving forward?
Well, I think just really sending the positive message of compassion and empathy for your neighbors in the Sullivan County community. You know, the pandemic has been tough on all of us. And, you know, Sullivan County was struggling with certain issues even before the pandemic happened, and people here are in crisis regardless of the pandemic. So this is really just to try to send the message that, you know, Sullivan County has the potential to be a very strong community that can work together and support every single person living here. And we need to come together and demonstrate that we are willing to stand with our neighbors and support them in whatever capacity they may need.
How are folks in at-risk communities doing? Like, for instance, like you're talking about, this is multiple aspects. You're talking about it's identity writ large, but specifically faith, race, or identity. Are there any issues specifically facing people of particular faiths at this time, people of specific gender identities? Are you hearing anything from individuals that are in those communities within our geographic area that issues that they want to have addressed?
Well, I mean, there are always issues that are ongoing within different minority communities, and whether people want to admit that they exist in Sullivan County or not, they most certainly do. And it's ignorance to think that, you know, everything here is peachy. And we just saw that this week with the students from the Livingston Manor School District posting inappropriate, racially charged images of pretend police brutality on social media. So this is something that does exist in Sullivan County. It's an issue here. I face this issue as a queer person living in this community, looking the way I do, shopping at the grocery store. And, you know, people just need to know that there are other people in this community who will step up and defend them and protect them, and that they're not alone in this struggle. And that goes for everybody, no matter how they identify or what group that they're a part of. We originally wanted to have this most recent Liberty event after the numerous incidences of violence against the Asian community. And although, you know, nothing has really been publicized about that locally here in Sullivan County, it has been in New York City specifically is like the hot spot for those acts of violence. And we are very close to that community. So, you know, we really just wanted to, once again, double down on our message that we won't stand for any kind of violence like that here in our community.
It's almost like this proactive stance of saying, well, why wait for some specific bad issue to happen when they could be happening and we don't even know, or it could easily happen. But more important, why don't we just demonstrate to people that this is how we want to be, that we want to have this type of unity, this type of support for people, even if they're in separate areas of the community. It's important to show that unified front at all times.
Yeah, and, you know, hate and that kind of, like, these ideas of violence and things like, that exists in the shadows before it's brought out into the light, and it's fed by this darkness. And, you know, compassion and empathy and love, on the other hand, all of these positive, strengthening emotions, that shines the light on that, and it kind of has the power and the potential to drive that out. So, like you said, we want to be proactive about it. We want to show that Sullivan County is a strong, unified force. Just really hope to see everybody Saturday, April 24th at 1 p.m. at LaPolt Park, 122 North Main Street in Liberty. We'll be out there spreading this message.
And is there any place to go online where people can not just find out about this event, but any future events you might be having?
We try to advertise them in different ways throughout Facebook. We normally send a press release out, too. And if anybody has any questions, they can email equityjusticesc@gmail.com.
And that SC stands for Sullivan County. Let's just give that a couple more times in case anybody's trying to write it down.
Thanks, Jason. It's equityjusticesc@gmail.com, and that's SC as in Sullivan County.
This is Radio Chatskill. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, the local efforts to battle a national problem, a decrease in volunteer firefighters. Stay with us.
I'm Rosie Starr, host of WJFF's Farm and Country.
Thanks to you, we've met our goal for our pledge drive. Thank you. You pledged your support for your community radio station. You have our pledge to keep you connected with the news you've come to rely on. We're here for you no matter what. WJFF Radio Catskill. Thank you.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Josh Gondelman explained why Starbucks is thriving during the pandemic while Subway is not.
Nobody's ever like, don't even talk to me till I've had my Italian cold cut combo.
I'm Peter Sagal. Get your juices flowing with us as we talk to Broadway superstar Andre DeShields on this week's News Quiz from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. According to a 2020 report from the National Fire Protection Association, the number of volunteer firefighters is trending downward. From 1987 to 2017, there was a slight increase in 2018, but overall, volunteer departments are struggling to recruit. More than 500 fire departments across New York are participating in the 9th annual Recruit New York Weekend this weekend. Recruit New York is a cornerstone campaign of the Firemen's Association of the State of New York with the goal of increasing membership in the volunteer fire service statewide. I spoke with John Hauschild, Sullivan County Fire Department coordinator, about the local recruitment efforts this weekend.
Recruit New York was brought about by the Firefighter Association of the State of New York, where they tried to do a weekend drive to recruit new members into the fire service. And there's several departments here in Sullivan County that are participating this year. Usually there's more, but with COVID, it's still have some restrictions. But some of our local fire departments that are doing it is Grahamsville Fire Department is doing it Saturday from 11 to 2. like Sheldrick Fire Department's doing it both Saturday and Sunday from 10 to 3. And these are all open houses where the people can come down and look at the equipment, meet the members, and if they're interested in volunteering, ask questions, get applications to join their local fire departments.
And you don't just need people to run into burning buildings. You need people to do a lot of other things. What are some of the other things that people can do to volunteer for the fire department?
Oh, absolutely. They can come out and they can do fire police work. They can do stuff around the station. They can do office work for the department. There's a lot. And then when they do join, they don't have to run into burning buildings, as you said. They can join like the dive task force, which consists of several departments here in the county. The dive task force is comprised of several departments, and it's an excellent water rescue and recovery organization. They're able to do underwater extrication. They dive, you know, do constantly dive rescue calls, and it's very good. And they can do, there's other things like search and rescue. We have a search and rescue team that can go out and assist the forest rangers in looking for lost persons. They have a lot of different things. Like the Rock Hill Fire Department has a drone team. They have a swift water team. Monticello has a trench collapse team that they're part of with Orange County. So there's a lot that people can do. And it's not just young people. It's all ages, or gender. It's anything, anybody that wants and has the interest to join are more than welcome to join.
This big push this weekend for Recruit New York is because volunteer fire departments across the state have seen a decrease in membership and an increase in the number of calls. Is that something you're seeing locally as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a national trend. It's a local trend. It's a state trend. So this weekend is a big push to try to get people because numbers are down. And it's a great organization. The fire service is a great family where you can meet people, take excellent training. And one thing in New York State, the fire train is all free. It's provided by Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Services, Office of Fire Prevention and Control, which is a mouthful. But if a firefighter is interested in, or a person's interested in joining and become a firefighter, the training is free and provided from the state to the local counties. And we have 8 fire instructors assigned to us here in the county from the state. So. So that's another, push. It's the fire service is very exciting, challenging, and you give back to the community, and that's what it's all about.
Do you think that the decrease in membership is it a generational thing, or do you think that people might just take it for granted? Do you know why, or is there any indications as to what causes the decrease in membership nationwide, as you said?
Well, I think it's all the above that you mentioned. I think part of it is... in our area, what we're seeing is we do have a lot of younger folks joining at 16. So we have them for 2 years, which is great. We train them and they become excellent firefighters. And then they go off to college and they don't come back. They don't return here to Sullivan County. But the way we look at it, if we get these younger folks or any folk to join and become members and they do move out of the area, they can volunteer wherever they move to. We've had firefighters here that took our training here and belonged to local departments that moved down to South Carolina, Tennessee, North Carolina, and became career firefighters. And even here in New York State, they became career firefighters. So it still benefits our community, and, it's a good thing. But I think the problem is we don't have people staying. And then the other thing that you said, there's a lot of people that are moving into the area that don't know that we are volunteers. Right. And it's, it seems to be a problem. And, we're looking for anybody to help. And the thing that we put together is a recruitment and retention task force started through the Bureau of Fire. And this is a big weekend for us, too, with that task force, because we are going live with some social media. We have a Facebook page, Join Sullivan County Fire. We have an Instagram page, and we have a direct email. So if people don't know where to go to join, they can go on those social media links, click on it, and when you click on our email, it automatically, if you show an interest, it will pop up a form that you can fill out, and it will come to our task force, and then we follow up with the local fire departments who of jurisdiction where this person wants to be a member.
While we have you, we'll give the information again about where folks can go this weekend to volunteer. But while we have you, any fire safety tips you want folks to know? I know that there's a burn ban still in effect in New York State, and other information that people should be aware of for safety.
It's just, you know, like you mentioned, the burn ban's in effect to the middle of May, May 14th. And some other things is just practice fire safety. I know we thought spring was here, but the last couple of days we had snow and the temperatures dropped. Yeah. But electrical heaters and space heaters and just using them the right way and extension cords, don't overload outlets and just stuff like that. And have working smoke detectors. The thing is, when you change your time, change your batteries and your smoke detectors. And we just had, you know, the time change, and people should have changed their batteries. And if they didn't, this is a reminder to do that. Prevention. You know, be careful when you're cooking, and be careful when you're, you know, working around portable heaters and alternate fuels. You know, it's just practice fire prevention.
Right. And this weekend is the big volunteer push, Recruit New York, moving forward to recruit some new volunteers. It's information available at sullivanny.us, but also they can get a hold of you directly, right, John?
Yes, they can get a hold of me at any time. If I'm not here, you know, they can email me, leave a message, and I can get back to them.
Yeah. And the Facebook page is there, an Instagram page, and then at Join Sullivan Fire is the Instagram handle. And there's an email, joinsullivanfire@gmail.com. It's this weekend, Grahamsville, Lock Sheldrake, Long Eddy, Woodridge, and Fallsburg having open houses. Check the website, the Facebook page, or the Instagram page, or email joinsullivanfire@gmail.com to find out hours and more information. And it looks like Mountaindale has something coming up May 8th. John Hauschild, the fire coordinator for Sullivan County, thank you so much for joining us.
You are more than welcome. It's my pleasure, and hopefully we get some new members, and everybody stay safe out there.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A horse is a horse, of course, unless it's a food digester. We'll explain after a short break.
I'm Noelle King. This moment is presenting so many challenges, including financial ones. If you're one of the listeners who recently donated to keep this NPR station strong, thank you. We know that money might be tight right now, and it means so much that you gave what you can to support this important service. Thanks again.
Your NPR station for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. We are Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. According to the National Resources Defense Council, almost half of the food in America is wasted. Food that is uneaten puts an unneeded strain on the environment and can cost money, up to $218 billion per year. But in Tustin, they want to lessen that burden and recently received a food digester that digests food scrap waste. WJFF's Patricio Ravallo has more.
Last Thursday, the Tustin Energy Committee celebrated by having a ribbon cutting of their special food scrap digester. Named the HORCH, which stands for High Solids Organic Waste Recycling System with Electrical Output, was manufactured by Impact Bioenergy in Seattle, Washington. And Tustin is actually the first town to operate a food scrap digester in the nation to be powered by a municipal solar array. Here's Jen Porter from the Tustin Energy Committee.
I am a resident of Tustin, New York, and a member of the Tustin Energy Committee, which was instrumental in bringing this project to the town, and I'm so thrilled to be here today. There are a billion people celebrating climate change innovations around the world today, I read this morning, and I'm thrilled that this group, both virtually and in person, is here doing this. The town of Tustin micro digester horse, which you can see here behind us, and food rescue program is funded through a 2018 New York DEC grant that was targeted at municipalities who wanted to do projects like this. And we are so thrilled to be here today. The HORSE stands for High Solids Organic Waste Recycling System with Electrical Output. Now, you don't have to have that memorized. You can Google HORSE and find it on there. But the DEC grant funds really made this possible for the purchase of the HORSE and coordination of all the education and outreach for this project. The HORSE, once it's operational, will create heat and power and also a soil fertilizer to help the earth. And all this will be produced from food scraps and paper in, for example, like napkins from local businesses in town through voluntary collection. So we are working on this grant to increase food rescue and donation, to install the actual unit, which we are so happy to be here with today, and to train the Energy Committee to have this be an ongoing project.
Randy Marola, also a member of the Tustin Energy Committee, was on hand and told us the history of the horse and how it came to be in Tustin.
The TEC was appointed 10 years ago, and at that time, we had a lot of ideas, and we've seen so many to fruition. And at this point, we're certified the 19th town, a climate smart community. Took a lot of goals and diligent work from our volunteers. Also, Councilwoman Jill Padua is on our committee, and she's running our Zoom event. Thanks, Jill. Anyway, I'd like to thank all these environmentally minded people. It's truly inspiring to work with people who love the environment and do the tireless work to protect it. The HORSE project came to the TEC from Jen and Scott. I thank them for their enthusiasm and for bringing waste, food waste to our attention with a solution. I told them we'd love to get a digester, but only if it were fully funded was it possible. So then Jen, a waste management specialist, applied for and got a fully funded grant from the DEC. We're so grateful to everyone who supported our project. The opening day of the farmers market at the Union in Narrowsburg is May 15th. Starting on that date, and then every Saturday throughout the season, the TEC will set up an informational tent to answer your questions about how and why we feed the horse. We'll hand out flyers and eventually food grade buckets with lids for residential food scrap collection, all given out for free. That brings me to my final thank you to the bakery department at Weiss Markets and Home Sale for their generous support of our food scrap program. Weiss offered to recycle their food grade buckets for use in feeding our horse. They've gifted us more than 55 gallon buckets for all of our local food merchants, as well as many, many small buckets for residents that'll be given out at the farmers market later this summer. The Tustin food merchants will start the program. We'll segue into residential collection later in the summer as we get our feet wet.
Former state senator for the 42nd District, Jan Metzger, also attended this press conference, and she gave some input on the benefits of having a composting site like this in Tustin.
Climate was really one of my top issues when I served in the state Senate. I worked on the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which we passed. It's nation-leading legislation to tackle climate change. And we've set the aggressive targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Emissions of methane from landfills is, you know, it's a huge source of our methane emissions. And methane is an incredibly potent greenhouse gas, 28 to 34 times more potent than carbon dioxide. It's short-lived, but it's super potent, and we have to address that. And town of Tustin is really like tackling this at the ground level in our community and showing the rest of Sullivan County communities and communities throughout New York State that, you know, we can do this. And I just want to express my appreciation. You're making a huge contribution to your community and to addressing, you know, the greatest environmental challenge humanity's ever faced. So thank you so much for your leadership. And I can't wait to hear about, you know, how the products of the microdigester are going to be used. I'm excited to hear from the farmer. And yeah, please keep me posted on it.
The horse is looking to be fully operational soon, as volunteers throughout the town will collect food scraps from residents and businesses to be fed into the machine, and the end products will be a probiotic plant food and biogas. For more information, visit the Tustin Energy Committee on Facebook. This is Patricia Rabal for WJFF Radio Catskill.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, a new exhibit in Foco, inspired by the 1973 in Foco exhibition of the same name. This is Radio Catskill. We'll be right back.
This week on This American Life, a Republican on a mission to convince fellow Republicans, Trump supporters, to get the COVID vaccine. He kind of has his work cut out for him.
When I say COVID-19 vaccine, what do you think of first? Patrick.
Rushed.
Diane from Ohio.
Unproven.
Michael from Oklahoma.
Don't hold my freedom hostage.
This week.
This American Life, Saturday evening at 6.
I'm WJFF volunteer Barb Demarest. Thank you for giving to this community radio station. You helped us reach our goal. You helped end the fund drive. Donations from people like you make this station possible. You value community radio for enhancing the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania as a place you'd love. And your contribution helps us serve the many diverse communities in our listening area. Thank you.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Dos Mundos, Reconstructing Narratives, is a traveling photography exhibition of 12 artists of color, all recipients of Enfoco's photography fellowships between 2016 and 2019. Enfoco is a nonprofit organization in the Bronx that primarily supports contemporary photographers of African, Asian, Latino, Native American, and Pacific Islander heritage based in the United States. The exhibition is inspired by the 1973 Enfoco exhibition of the same name, which showcased work by Puerto Rican photographers who were committed to examining the shifting narratives and challenges of Latinos, both in the El Barrio neighborhood of New York City and in Puerto Rico. Currently, the exhibition is at SUNY Binghamton and at the Binghamton University Art Museum until May 15th, and will make its way to SUNY Stony Brook in July. WJFF's Patricio Rubio spoke with the curators of the show, Juanita Lanzo and Stephanie Lindquist.
Now, Dos Mundos means two worlds in Spanish. What are the two worlds that this exhibition is looking to examine? Stephanie, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of worlds that these artists belong to. You know, Damaris Alvarez in her work, she's documenting pug culture in Cuba. So she's dipping out of that world, and then the world here in the U.S. We have Cynthia Briones Santos, who's dipping into the sanctuaries where immigrants are fleeing to. And so she's dipping in and out of that world. Hambusi, too, works very closely with Coney Island Public Housing and is establishing relationships there. And I guess I'll finish with saying that, you know, these artists also they also work and live in privileged spaces of universities as teachers. So they are going in between and serving as a medium.
And how about you, Juanita?
Just to segue on what Stephanie answered, one of the things that also attracted to us is these accessibility or maybe ease that these artists also construct and form new identities and dualities within stereotypes that are expected from people. So just to add to that.
In the press release, this was says it was inspired by the 1973 exhibition of the same name. Stephanie, I don't know if you want to talk about why did you want to bring this theme back and revisit it again?
I mean, that exhibition was also the start in some ways of Enfoco, right? And so in some ways, we wanted to pay homage to that And that was important for the organization of Infoco to do that. One of the big differences, though, in how Infoco has evolved since then is that now through the fellowship program, the organization is supporting artists of all colors, not just Puerto Rican artists. So in this show, we have Taiwanese artists, we have other Afro-Caribbean artists, we have an Egyptian artist. So it has expanded, but I think Infoco still understands that these artists really do need this support, and they really do need a platform for their work that is just not being given by the New York art world and wasn't given to those Puerto Rican artists in 1973 and was the reason why they came together and organized that show.
Right. And how about you, Juanita? Do you share the same sentiment that Stephanie did?
Yeah, actually, and what is interesting, Stephanie and I actually started working in this project in like 2018, 2017, and we were both attracted from our different points of view. We're both artists, we're both curators. The other thing to add is that Infoco formed also at a time where many artists were fighting for equity within the art world. And along with that equity, they were also looking into all these other civil rights issue that were going on at the time, the young lords in East Harlem, New York, Chicago, etc. So it's going along with those lines. And yeah, the mission of Infoco had expanded to include other artists of color that are part of the African, Asian, and Latino diasporas.
Right. So that sort of leads into my next question. You sort of answered it a little bit. Since the 1973 exhibition, 40 plus years have passed. How have things changed for Latinos in New York or people of color in New York? And you mentioned the press release Puerto Rico. How have things changed in this time frame, and how have things stayed the same?
Well, I was just thinking that Stefan and I were in touch when we heard a verdict on the Chauvin trial for the death of George Floyd. And just to think of that, and not too far after the original Infoco exhibition happened in 1973, a Puerto Rican, a young man also died in custody of police in Rikers, Rikers Island here in New York City. So we will say that a lot of rights and a lot of protections and a lot of policymaking has changed, that it's in benefit, or you could say that it allows for equity for Black and brown people. But systemic racism is a reality, and it still affects people, and it kills disproportionately Latinos, Indigenous, and African Americans. So that has not changed, and I think that there's a big push to make that change and to change that.
Right, and it's like this exhibition gives an audience, or should say, or gives them a platform to those artists that sometimes are, I feel, my personally, this is my personal view, that are sometimes are not available to people of color. So I'm really happy that this exhibition is going around and going around in upstate New York. So
yeah, I was just going to add too, just like speaking of like creating platforms, the artists in the exhibition too are also creating their own platforms, not just for themselves, but for their peers, other artists of color. Layla Amatula Bahrain, she has in collaboration created like the second anthology ever of celebrating women photographers of color of the diaspora. So the fact that that's the second anthology ever just goes to show, you know, not that much has changed in the art world outside of like, you know, our real day-to-day world. And again, similarly, Aaron Turner, he's also supporting photographers of color with his center in Arkansas, at the University of Arkansas. So I think these artists are really aware that a lot of change needs to happen, even within this field, amongst themselves.
Right, no, definitely. And it's, I mean, there was a couple of articles recently about how sort of racism not only was built into like photography, how the skin tones were for Black and brown people, the film just wasn't made for them, and they weren't into consideration. So it's amazing that sort of was built into that.
And in our language, right? Then which we talk about photography, right? Like, what do? You shoot, you take a shot, you know, when you're taking a photo. or Layla corrected me real quick in a talk when I was speaking about the subjects in her photography. And she was like, let's not call them subjects. They're people in my photographs, you know, so just to think about, yeah, how that power dynamic is so clearly reflected in the medium.
Right. No, definitely. And to have like a you know, a person of color be the photographer and them photographing a person of color, there's always automatic sort of like comfort level that the subject, that the person that they're being photographed. So, and not only that, I think it will allows people to have, I guess, a more in-depth look into subjects. Like, say, if a person who is not Black or Brown, you know, exploring the subject in Puerto Rico or El Barrio, and they might not have the access that that Black and Brown people would have. So it, I see in my way I look at it is that you're seeing things that might not have been seen in the regular art world with the artists that are represented. How do you think technology has changed that connection for people of color with either their homeland or their family's homeland?
You know what is interesting with this exhibition? We have these, maybe not so much with Puerto Ricans. I will say that in general with indigenous African-American or people from the African diaspora and Latinos, I think there's a way and a desire and a drive to reach out and connect that had facilitated and also created a divide between communities, right? I was just thinking on how through the photographs of Layla or Layla Tula Bahrain, I'm able to travel to Africa and connect to the work. Also with, I mean, there's an immediacy with the medium, and I know that it changed from like film to digital, but also I was thinking how it's a paradox and it's a contradiction because there's something that the medium is allowing artists to do by making it more flexible and stretch it. But also, and there's also this desire that families have to remain connected when they go across the borders or if they live abroad or they go back and forth and move between one country and another. But also, I'm thinking that there's also within that a bridge or a divide, and I'm going to mute myself, but I hope that answers the question in terms of how we feel that technology have affected that.
Right. I guess providing technology sort of provides access to people to do work. I say, make 1973, you know, you had to buy a film camera that's sort of expensive, buy to have the film to process and all that. And now we all have cell phones, which take pretty good photographs. And I'm in the belief that it's not the equipment, it's the person behind the equipment that makes the artwork. So I guess technology gives the accessibility to everyone to create work. Stephanie, do you agree with that or do you have thoughts on that?
No, definitely. Maybe to expand on that, you know, these artists are not, they've also kind of stretched the meaning of photography. So like Antonio Pulgarin, for instance, like he's including collaged elements in his work, exploring identity, masculinity, sexuality, and being able to like edit and remove through collage is allowing him to like reflect on his heritage in a different way. Similarly, like Aaron Turner is using, you know, installation, sometimes drawing. He's like creating these really elaborate sets, which he's very physically involved with. And that's also allowing him to think about like abstraction and how that relates to Black identity in different ways. So yeah, they're kind of pulling at the medium too.
And going on that technology, looking at the InFocal website now, since we're in the age of pandemic and not everyone can make it to the gallery or travel that far to get to the gallery, I noticed that you guys have a virtual gallery that you guys could explore and see. Stephanie, do you guys want to talk about how that sort of came together, the virtual thing, and how has that sort of expanded the views of the gallery?
I consider Stephanie the queen of layouts and designing exhibitions. So I don't know if she wants to give some of the trade-off, but it's amazing. She and I have not been able to physically visit the exhibitions because of the pandemic, distance, and commitments, which is ironic, right? After we work so hard and we think who should go next to what. But Stephanie, share a little bit about the layout, and actually in a way by having interviews and the audio by the artists. We're also trying to make this exhibition accessible to people that will not go to a gallery and actually they don't have an art background, perhaps, or a photography background. But
yeah, I agree with Juanita. Like, I really encourage folks to go to the Enfoco website, check out the Dos Mundos exhibition. There are really great audio clips of the artists there. And we were really lucky. So as the show has been traveling through the SUNYs, it started at New Paltz. And the curators there were really gracious in connecting with folks near them that could come and then take a 3D scan of the space so that we would have a virtual exhibition on the website. And as it travels, you know, depending on the capabilities of the site, they've been able to accommodate that. And just make it accessible because, you know, folks have to be safe and they can't make it out necessarily.
No, definitely. And actually, that was one of my questions because I noticed you have another exhibition up and I went to that virtual gallery and it was a different room. So it was great that, you could have a representation of that room. So for those who want to see that virtual website, they could visit the website infoco.org and look for Dos Mundos for reconstructing narratives. Before we go, anything else that we haven't spoken about that you want our listeners to know about this exhibition, about Infoco, or anything else coming up in the future?
And I wanted to say one thing just to go back to what we were talking about briefly about how important it is to have a person of color behind the camera. I just wanted to give a shout out to Roger Richardson and Tao Batiste in the exhibition, who Tao Batiste is from St. Kitts Nevis. And for the exhibition, he has two works of two gentlemen. One is of Brother Rainbow and the other one is of JJ. And these are folks that, at least Brother Rainbow, he has known since he was a child, right? So that image and that kind of love that he's giving to his community and the honor he is returning to them through taking their images, I think is really felt by the person being photographed. And they are happy to have him come and photograph him. And then Roger Richardson too, in upstate New York, has just spent, he'll go out into the street and photograph people, but he will spend time engaging with folks first. And I think that comes through in the images. We can see that intimacy. We can see that softness. And even though it's a space with a lot of racial, political, economic tension, they still feel so soft and so healing. So I just want to give a shout out to these artists and all the artists, right, for taking the time to establish those relationships because it's right. Felt.
I guess it's that... like we talked before, that sort of that intimacy that you have with a person who's in that world, mm-hmm. documenting somebody else who's also in that world.
Yeah, it has that sensibility and it can engage and it takes the time also to nurture and build these relationships, which we think are so important.
And I'll also mention Erica Murillo, perhaps one of the most intimate relationships in the show between a mother, Erica Murillo, and her son, that she photographed until he was about 10 years old. And they're really striking images, and some of them might even make you a little bit uncomfortable. But, that's partially because she has a background in psychology and just takes really interesting compositions. But, it brings up questions of, how do we parent? How do we nurture? And kind of pushes maybe our usual ideas forward.
Juanita, do you have anything else or?
Other than enjoying working with Stephanie and working with these artists and following their work outside of the Dos Mundos exhibition, I want to say that this is a type of exhibition that we got involved because these are the artists we've been working with. We think that people working within their communities or observing them or having the respect to approach them means a lot to us. It's actually part of our politics as artists, curators, and the things we're engaged with the community. So we're happy and we hope people get to see Dos Mundos, look at the online materials, listen to the artists' statements, audios, and that, we look forward to see what happens and what happens with this group of 12 artists after this exhibition finishes touring.
Well, Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on the air with us and talking to us. We were talking with the curators of Dos Mundos, Reconstructing Narratives. It's a traveling exhibition currently at SUNY Binghamton at the Binghamton University Art Museum until May 15th. After that, it will make its way to SUNY Stony Brook in July. And I see on the website that it's possible for 2022 exhibitions.
Well, we want a venue in New York City. So we're like, yeah, we have to have a coffee with Bill or something. We look forward to that. It will be great to have it back.
And to see the virtual website, the virtual gallery, you check out infoco.org. Again, thank you so much for joining me, and I really appreciate you giving up your time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, stay tuned for updates, hopefully coming to the Bronx.
Thank you. Oh, and there's some information on Dos Mundos, a catalog that Stefan and I work this summer. So, oh, you have your copy. Excellent. I was like, wait, we have to. That was a labor of love. And he gave me excuses to call Stephanie and talk to her during the summer. So thank you so much. So yeah, get your copy of Dos Mundos, Nueva Luz also. Thank you so
much. Okay, and how they pick it up? Do you get that from the website?
Yes, that information is on the website, and people can acquire this copy of the Nueva Luz for sure, along with the one that assists in the fellows and other wonderful photographers that have been featured through and forgot to the fellowship. Another other thematic / exhibition publications.
Awesome. Great. Thank you so much, everyone. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye.
This is Patricia Robile for WJFF Radio Catskill.
That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. And remember, be kind, wear a mask, and get your vaccine. We'll see you next week.
From Rourke Law, Liberty, New York, a general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, featuring a state-of-the-art cinema available for private rental. Plan an afternoon or evening at the movies for yourself, that special someone, your family, or your pod. HurleyvilleArtsCenter.org. From the River Reporter newspaper in Narrowsburg, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Nairobi is roaring into the 2020s. The Kenyan capital is bursting with new sounds, from neo-soul to gengetone. Hello, I'm Josh Kodine. Join me and guest co-host Eric Wainaina for Nairobi Roars. Next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRX.
Saturday night at 9 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Doug Sandberg, host of WJFF's Let's Talk Vets. Thank you for supporting WJFF. Thanks to you, we made our goal. You made sure WJFF could stay focused in keeping community connected and informed. You gave what you could. You made it happen. You stood up for your community radio station. Thank you for supporting WJFF. Radio Catskill.
The forecast for the Catskills in northeast Pennsylvania, today mostly sunny with highs in the mid-60s. Tonight, mostly cloudy. There's a slight chance of showers after midnight, lows in the lower 40s. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, showers likely, mainly in the morning with highs in the lower 60s, wind gusts up to 20 miles an hour in the afternoon. It'll be sunny and highs in the upper 50s Monday, but warming up into the lower 80s by Wednesday. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, W233 AH Monticello, public radio for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. We are Radio Catskill.
Estás escuchando Radio Catskill, radio pública para The Catskill y el noreste de Pensilvania.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008. Proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. W23.